From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And according to the Washington Post and the New York Times, the White House is trying to discredit Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation by looking for conflicts of interest in the investigators. Members of the president's legal team say that is not true. But the Post also claims Trump has asked advisors about his pardon power. Well, what are the legal questions raised by these reports? Brian Kalt is a law professor at Michigan State University, author of the book Constitutional Cliffhangers, A Legal Guide for Presidents and Their Enemies. Professor, start with pardons. What power does a president have? Can he pardon anyone for any reason, including himself?
Well, he does have a pretty broad power to pardon anyone for any reason. There might still be a political price to pay for it. He might be impeached for it. Pardoning himself is a gray area, though. There are arguments on both sides. The simplest argument is that he can do it because the Constitution doesn't specifically say that he can't. But the argument on the other side is that there are certain things inherent in the notion of what a pardon is, and one of those might be that it's something you can only give to someone else. Like you can't donate something to yourself. And there's also a very old legal principle that you can't be the judge in your own case. I tend to favor the arguments that say that he cannot pardon himself, but we really don't know until it happens.
Does a pardon have to come with an acknowledgement of guilt?
That's a very common misconception, and it's understandable why people think that, because almost every pardon that's been issued has been forgiving someone who is guilty. And when they accept the pardon, they're admitting that they're guilty and being contrite. But the pardon power goes farther than that, and it does encompass the ability of the president to exonerate people. And so The president, if the optics were right, if the politics were right, he could say, I'm pardoning myself because I did nothing wrong. Now, politically, it might be a little problematic. He might lose some support in Congress, which is where ultimately the most important judgments are made here.
Right. Impeachment. And again, we're talking just what legal questions are. We have no other purpose here. What about the reported claims from Trump's legal team that some of the investigators being hired by Special Prosecutor Mueller have conflicts of interest, that some of them contributed money, for instance, to Hillary Clinton's campaign? Well, actually, we hear that there is a list of things that are conflicts of interest when there's a special investigation, and political donations is not on that list.
Yeah, I think that the point of raising those points is less to have an argument that would go anywhere in court and more about potentially discrediting the investigation for the public, in the media.
And the court of public opinion, yeah.
Yeah.
What about President Trump's interview with the New York Times in which he said that if Special Prosecutor Mueller were to ask him certain questions about finances, it would be crossing a line? That raised eyebrows because people asked, well, then what? Can a president fire a special prosecutor? Tell us, there's some history there.
Well, there's some constitutional awkwardness anytime the president is being pursued by his own executive branch, because constitutionally he has to retain that ultimate authority over the executive branch. So he can either fire the independent counsel or make the person who has the power to fire more directly do it. And President Nixon, the so-called Saturday Night Massacre, did that. He told the attorney general to fire the independent counsel. The attorney general wouldn't, so Nixon fired the attorney general, and on until he found someone willing to do it. The only recourse there was political. President Trump would be able to do that, but he would have to consider the political cost. And, of course, impeachment is always looming in the background. So if Congress felt like there needed to be an investigation, they could hire Bob Mueller and his whole team the day after that, and there'd be nothing the president would be able to do about that.
We have a question from a listener, Douglas Hardy, who asks, if a prosecutor, in this case Special Prosecutor Mueller, asked a president, President Trump, for his tax returns, is the president legally obligated to give them? And if Mueller gets them, are they necessarily public?
Well, they wouldn't be necessarily public, But I don't think that it would be any problem for the investigators to get at that information. I mean, the IRS already has it. So that would not be, as a legal matter, that would not be remarkable.
That's Brian Kalt, law professor at Michigan State University, author of the book Constitutional Cliffhangers, A Legal Guide for Presidents and Their Enemies. Professor, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Iraq has declared victory over ISIS in the battle for control of Mosul, but the fight for the hearts and minds of people there continues. Iraqi counterterrorism forces are combing the city's neighborhoods to try to root out ISIS supporters. Some of them are just teenagers. Journalist Simona Foltin was in Mosul earlier this week. She joins us from nearby Erbil on Skype. Simona, you did a report for French TV, and in it you accompanied these Iraqi troops as they went door to door. They started very early in the morning. What did they do?
So basically, the counterterrorism forces, they are looking for sleeper cells in West Mosul. Even though West Mosul has been officially liberated, there are still suspected Islamic State group fighters that have managed to escape from the old city or who've been able to get away, for example, by blending into the population. So they have a list of names, and they're combing through the neighborhoods, going from house to house, asking families if they know anybody, for example, who has worked for ISIS. So it's very much an effort to collaborate with the local community, and the forces are very much reliant on the local community. Without their support and the intelligence that they're getting from them, it's very difficult to do. And, you know, if somebody from within the community says that, let's say my neighbor, for example, you know, he was ISIS, then they have to take that piece of information and verify it.
It sounds like it makes it a rather difficult dynamic from neighbor to neighbor. But what kind of success did they have? You were following them as they knocked door to door. What did you see?
It seemed to me that there was a little bit of nervousness and suspicion on the part of the population, who is, of course, Sunni, and the security forces are mostly Shia. So there is that kind of dynamic going on. There is a perception that the security forces are penalizing the entire community simply because they are Sunni. So the first few hours there were not many leads, but then finally they managed to find a 14-year-old boy who actually admitted that he joined ISIS, and they took him to his family's home and interrogated him, and then he was arrested. And it was a pretty difficult situation because obviously he's underage, he's only 14 years old, and it's a very tricky situation that they have to maneuver because they don't want to alienate the family. They still have to win the hearts and minds of these people to ensure continued support. So basically the commander promised them that they would bring him back if he shared information to find other members of ISIS, more important ones, more senior ones.
Now, this boy, 14 years old, I mean, he looks like a fresh-faced kid, and we know that ISIS recruits young people. What was his role? What had he done as an ISIS supporter?
So that's very interesting because during the interrogation, he tried to downplay his role. He said he was mostly a guard. He didn't really have any important duties. What I was told by the special forces was, in fact, that he had shown up in several propaganda videos for ISIS and that he was very much a core member of the group. So he was handed over to the intelligence services, and he's still in detention right now.
So he pointed to one of his neighbors who he said was also an ISIS supporter. Tell us about that person.
Yeah, so basically we got into the Humvee together with this 14-year-old, and he showed us the way to another person. So it's very much like once you have one person, then you're on the right track, and they reveal the identities of others. So we went to the house of another suspected militant, and he was not as cooperative. He denied that he played any significant role. He said he initially joined, but then defected. So he was also taken in for interrogation, but he was later released because there was no conclusive evidence that he was a core member of the group.
In the big picture, how far do you think these operations, door-to-door operations, are going to make Mosul safer? Especially knowing that Mosul needs to be rebuilt. And right now it's a city of 30,000 homes that are destroyed. There's no water, no electricity. What's the future hold?
One of the things that the commander I was with pointed out is that the thing that he fears most is how neighbors will look upon families who've had somebody join ISIS, that they will not respect them anymore, that there could even be reprisals. For example, if somebody was killed by an ISIS member and you know that your neighbor supported them, or perhaps that one of their sons joined, in other cities that have already been liberated, this has proven a challenge. So in some cities, for example, families of ISIS members were not allowed to return, which is, of course, also problematic, because then you end up having, you know, certain camps outside cities where you have these families. And of course, this fuels a lot of resentment. And you think about, if, let's say, if you're a young boy of, you know, 8 years old, and let's say your family has been confined to a camp and cannot return home, how are you going to grow up? What are you going to think about your government when you're a teenager? And this is just this cycle of violence that just keeps being fueled and fueled. So if that is not addressed properly, then it's very difficult to see how there will be peace in Iraq in the future.
Journalist Simona Foltin speaking with us from Erbil in Iraq. Simona, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's been Made in America Week at the White House. President Trump showcasing products made in every state as part of what he calls a commitment to preserving American jobs for American citizens, even though, as his critics point out, his family products are made overseas. But much of the president's message this week has been targeted at the Midwest, states that have lost manufacturing jobs over the years and in many cases voted for President Trump. Here he is speaking at a factory in Kenosha, Wisconsin in April.
Together, we're going to do everything in our power to make sure that more products are stamped with those wonderful words, Made in the USA.
Well, on that same trip to Wisconsin, Trump was asked about a measure sponsored by Wisconsin's Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin that would require water infrastructure projects in the U.S. to use American-made steel and iron. Trump said he supported it 100%. The measure passed the Senate as part of a broader infrastructure bill, but was not included in the House version. Senator Tammy Baldwin joins us now. And, Senator, your thoughts on your stalled bill?
Yes. Well, let me start to put it in context. The measure incorporated in the Water Infrastructure Act passed the Senate on a 95-3 vote. But when it went over to the House, I learned in December of last year that Paul Ryan and the Republicans working on that measure stripped out my reform. And I was shocked to learn that it was done at the behest of lobbyists working for foreign steel manufacturers, Russian and Brazilian steel importers, to be specific. And it was shocking to me. So I reintroduced the measure, this reform, as a standalone bill. I was delighted to hear President Trump endorse my measure on a visit to Wisconsin. And I called on him to follow up his words with actions. And I'm still calling on him to do that.
Well, let's back up a second, Senator, because you mentioned Ryan and the other lawmakers who you say at the behest of foreign lobbyists stripped your measure out at that time. But they say it's because, as Republicans, they don't feel that they should cherry pick which domestic company gets support. And some domestic companies would and some wouldn't, because not all domestic companies use American-made steel, and there's a reason for it. Earlier this year, we spoke to Brett Gouge. He's executive vice president of California Steel Industries. We were talking about the president's January executive order calling on the Department of Commerce to maximize the use of American-made steel. And Brett Gouge said that would hurt his business because he can't get the raw products he needs from American-made steel. He has to use imports. Let's listen.
Well, that would be a big concern because our business model for 32 years has been to rely on purchased slab, and because of the way the domestic steel industry has evolved, there's almost none available domestically.
So Senator, there isn't the kind of U.S. steel that you're calling on American companies to solely use.
You know, that is not my experience. I have been throughout the state of Wisconsin in visits to manufacturers, seeing many producers of steel pipes, iron pipes, and in the case of Nina Foundry in the state of Wisconsin, the manhole covers that are so iconic across the globe. And I'm not talking about constraining decisions in commerce. I'm talking about when we are using taxpayer dollars, mm-hmm. that I want those taxpayer dollars for drinking water projects, infrastructure projects, to support U.S. workers and U.S. iron and steel. Now, I do represent a state that is one of the leading manufacturing states, but I've seen the hits that we've taken over time. And I believe that this sort of policy is one that makes sure that we don't allow our manufacturing sector to die.
Mm. Look, you're talking to someone with people in Wauwatosa. So, you know, we don't.
Yeah,
we want it to be robust. But, you know, what do you say to people in other parts of the country or other industries who say, wait a second, President Trump also said this week that he's considering tariffs to protect the American steel industry. In other words, tariffs on imports of steel. So it would be more expensive. And they're saying, well, where do you stop? I mean, should we put tariffs on and, you know, fill in the blank, iPhone parts that come from other parts of the world, which will also raise the cost of that product? You know, would you be in favor of that?
We've had times in our nation when the competition is actually state-supported enterprises. And the direct intent is to drive U.S. competition out of business. If you don't have countervailing duties at your disposal or tariffs, they're going to win that battle with that unlevel playing field. You know, if we have a level playing field, we will do just fine. But when they can subsidize and dump product, whether it's steel or other product, and successfully drive manufacturing in the United States out, that's a big problem, and policymakers ought to be on top of it.
Senator Tammy Baldwin, the Democrat from Wisconsin. Senator Baldwin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, we got some news yesterday on Twitter about that controversial laptop ban on some flights to the U.S. from the Middle East. The Department of Homeland Security spokesman tweeted, "With enhanced security measures in place, all restrictions on large personal electronic devices announced in March for 10 airports, 9 airlines, have been lifted. So passengers on those planes can carry their laptops again." What have people been seeing on those laptops and in social media? Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English, joins us from Washington. Hi, Femi.
Hello there.
And let's start with the sad news this week about John McCain and his brain cancer diagnosis. It sent a lot of people to social media and a certain video from John McCain's 2008 presidential campaign. It started with that question from a woman at a town hall.
I got to ask you a question. I do not believe in, I can't trust Obama. I have read about him, and he's an Arab. He is not.
No, ma'am. He's a decent family man, citizen that I just happen to have disagreements with on fundamental issues, and that's what this campaign is all about. He's not.
Yeah, Femi, we remember that video. He literally grabbed the microphone away from her.
Like, Stop that lady from talking. Give me the mic.
People are sharing this. What are they saying?
Well, this was a town hall from 2008. It was in Lakeville, Minnesota. There were boos when Senator McCain actually had that pushback to the lady. But the Nicole D. Wallace says, "I was lucky to be there. It was powerful at the time because he didn't mean for it to be any sort of moment." Baz Bazenboim on Twitter calls the Senator McCain a statesman. There's always more than one conversation going online, particularly when there's a big tweet, which this video is, of Senator John McCain actually maybe talking about some old-fashioned political values. You can be gentlemen in politics and disagree with each other. But there's a little bit of subtext. The lady in the town hall said he's an Arab. And then Senator McCain says, no, he's a good family man. And then a lot of people out on Twitter were saying, hang on a minute. Those two things don't have to be mutually exclusive. So a number of conversations going on there, but mostly being very appreciative of Senator McCain and what he has brought to politics over the years.
Well, he was in a tough spot there because when people were calling Barack Obama both an Arab and a Muslim, it was in a derogatory way, and he was responding to that.
We're looking back 10 years, and also the political climate has changed so much, which is why I believe this piece of video is doing so well online.
Well, it's interesting because I've been hearing from younger people who had never heard of it. So he's brought that moment back, and we wish him the best. But look, there was also a viral tweet yesterday from Tesla CEO Elon Musk about his idea for building this Hyperloop, it's called, between Washington and New York City, this kind of underground bullet train kind of thing. What did he say?
All right. So he says, I just received verbal government approval for the boring company. That's his company. It's not a snoozy company. It's a tunnel boring company. And his company has got verbal approval to build on the underground New York to Philadelphia, Baltimore, D.C. Hyperloop, New York to D.C. in 29 minutes.
Yeah, this would be incredible if he did get permission for this. Did he? What did people in New York City and the Trump administration, what's everybody saying?
Well, people online were like, huh? And then there was a hashtag verbal approval and all the things that you had verbal approval to do, being slightly snarky. Ben Saul, he's the deputy press secretary at the New York City mayor's office, says, Elon, you've got to be joking. Nobody in City Hall or any of our city agencies has heard from Elon Musk or any representatives of his company. So the press office at the New York City mayor may not have heard, but Brian Fong, who's the tech reporter at the Washington Post, did a little bit of digging. And apparently it is true. The White House says it had promising conversations with Elon Musk on the DC New York Hyperloop, and they are very interested in transformative infrastructure. And if you think of yourself being in a little pod, that pod in a steel tube that goes from city to city, you could cross the United States in about 1 hour. You could get up the Eastern Seaboard in 20, 30 minutes maximum. This is what he's envisioning, and this is what he's actually putting out there as an idea, and he has verbal approval.
But, Femi, what I love is that all of this, or at least a lot of it, is taking place on social media.
Yes.
Which we discussed, this huge project.
It's a good place to pitch.
Yeah. Femi, okay.
Your transformative transport system.
Right. You know, just put it out there. Somebody might say,
see
okay.
See what happens.
Right.
See if it floats.
Femi, okay, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Thanks as always.
You're welcome. Have a great weekend.
You too. And earlier today, a scrum of reporters, some of them standing on chairs, gathered at the closed door of the White House press office waiting for information on the news that White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer resigned because President Trump named Wall Street financier and supporter Anthony Scaramucci communications director. Now, this news comes during a week in which there seemed to be an intravenous line of leaks from the White House to the major papers. The president himself, in an interview with the New York Times, publicly criticized his attorney general, Jeff Sessions, and warned special counsel Robert Mueller not to look into his personal finances. NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro is here. Domenico, as I list what's happened this week, was there a sense that there had to be a change in how news is handled?
Well, I think that Sean Spicer has been somebody who has taken a step back a bit. He's been somewhat sidelined in this Trump White House. You know, Trump has not been totally pleased with how he was presenting information at the podium. And he had been lampooned on Saturday Night Live. Trump from day two really didn't really like his presentation, thought that he should wear different kinds of clothing, should speak in a kind of different way. And it's not his kind of guy. You know, overall, this is a DC character in Sean Spicer, somebody who has worked in agencies here through the Republican National Committee, was brought on board because Reince Priebus, who was the head of the Republican National Committee and now chief of staff to President Trump, said that he should be somebody who is there. Now we're seeing the New York wing take over.
Yes, I was going to say, now you got a New York character. Meanwhile, Sean Spicer became an SNL caricature. But now you have Anthony Scaramucci, a fighter, a scrapper, ran a hedge fund in the 2016 primaries. He fundraised for Scott Walker and Jeb Bush, nicknamed the Mooch. He just is a fighter, scrappy. What is this telling you?
Well, Anthony Scaramucci is somebody who Donald Trump has seen a lot on CNN. Frankly, he thinks making the argument pretty well. He probably likes his presentation. He likes how he dresses. He likes how he talks. He likes also, remember, CNN had to retract a story and three producers or three reporters had to resign after a story came out about Trump advisor who had been, tied to Russia, etc. Well, that was Anthony Scaramucci. And Scaramucci very graciously wrote CNN on Twitter and said, you know, this is I'll move on, appreciate that this was done. And I think Trump likes that he was able to kind of win one against CNN. But this is somebody in Anthony Scaramucci who had been in charge of something called Skybridge Capital. It was a hedge fund. He organizes the largest hedge fund conference in Las Vegas every year. He also organizes a wine tasting event in the Swiss Alps. So he's a real schmoozer. He's somebody who's a backslapper. He's known to have a lot of personality in those circles. And Trump likes what he sees when he sees him and how he talks.
Just a few seconds here, but one unnamed White House official, there's a lot of them, told Politico that hiring Scaramucci is a murdering of Reince Priebus and Steve Bannon, who Bannon in particular we haven't seen much of. Just briefly, is there going to be a power play there?
Everyone in this White House is always on the hot seat. So Steve Bannon and Reince Priebus, I wouldn't be surprised if either or both quits at some point. I would also not be surprised if they both hang around. The fact of the matter is Scaramucci is somebody who knows how to get in the good graces of the president, which is something that Priebus and Bannon were able to do, and now they have competition.
He also sounds like that old rock song, Scaramucci. Domenico Montanaro, lead politics editor for NPR, thank you.
Alrighty, thank you.
Television this year has been dominated by female talent. What's more, female talent in complex and beefy roles. As a result, the competition in this fall's Emmy Awards is shaping up to be especially stiff. For more on the changing look of the TV landscape, we turn to Eric Deggans, NPR TV critic. Hi, Eric.
Hey.
Eric, one of the prevailing stories about women in entertainment is inequality in gender representation. So how different is this year?
Well, what's really been interesting is even before the Emmy nominations got announced, I was thinking about 2017 as the year of women on television, not just because there's so many great roles for women in signature series like Big Little Lies on HBO or The Handmaid's Tale on Hulu or Harlots also on Hulu. But because so many of these productions, women are creative forces behind the scenes, and we're seeing a ton of these shows this year.
So you're saying there are more roles for women actresses because there are more women writers who are writing roles for them?
Well, I don't know. I haven't done a numeric study to say if there's more, but I do have a sense as a critic who's been watching this for a while that the roles are more complex characters and more well-rounded characters. And one reason why I think that's happening is because women are involved in creating these characters. Insecure on HBO, Issa Rae, the star, is also the executive producer, co-creator, and intimately involved with the writing. Harlots, the show I mentioned on Hulu, all women were involved in terms of creating the show, executive producing it, and most of the directors. These are visions that are created from the female gaze, and so these characters, I think, are more well-rounded, more central to the story. They avoid a lot of tropes and stereotypes about female characters that we've seen, and all of that has added up to an exciting array of characters that have now been recognized by the Emmy Academy and some of these nominations we've seen.
So if they're avoiding the old tropes, what are the new tropes? I mean, we have six performers, so let's take a look at the subset, a special subset. Six performers up for an Emmy Award for Actress in a Drama, seven for Actress in a Comedy Series. What kind of parts do they play?
Well, okay, so if we look at comedy series first, my prediction for who I think is going to do well here is Julia Louis-Dreyfus from Veep. And that is not a hard prediction to make because she's been nominated over 20 times. And she's won an Emmy as Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for the last 5 years running. And this character, Selina Meyer, she was vice president, sort of through a quirk of things, became president for a little while, you know, tried to be elected president, failed. And Veep is just this really great sort of comedy about how dysfunctional Washington is, and her character is at the center of it, ultimately dysfunctional. But Julia Louis-Dreyfus has a great way of playing this character. And when you look at the nominees and comedy actress, you see this nice little balance between people who've been around for a while, including Lily Tomlin and Tracee Ellis Ross from Black-ish, and some new voices like Pamela Adlon from FX's Better Things, and Ellie Kemper from Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. So if we look at the dramatic actress category, my pick to win there is Elizabeth Moss from A Handmaid's Tale. This was, I think, 2017's best new show so far. You know, an amazing retelling of a classic book, and Elizabeth Moss's character as this woman who's been turned into a sexual slave by a theocratic society. And this role is an exemplar to me of the kinds of roles that are available to actresses now. You look at these categories, even the supporting categories, and you see a quality of role that you didn't see 10 years ago. Let's check out this clip of Elizabeth Moss playing Offred.
Now, Anchorage is the capital of what's left of the United States. And the flag that flies over that city has only two stars. Now, darkness and secrets are everywhere. Now there has to be an us. Because now there is a them.
A Handmaid's Tale, of course, the book written by Margaret Atwood. Eric, while we have you, the BBC has announced that a woman, the first ever, is going to be playing the Doctor in the newest season of the British sci-fi Doctor Who. Are you as outraged as apparently some Brits are?
God, no. I'm happy. I'm loving this. I mean, we've seen a long succession of actors play that character because there's a convention where the character regenerates every so often and it gives them a chance to put a new actor in the role. We've seen a lot of different takes on a white male. I think it's time now for them to broaden the possibilities for the character, and it's a good time for a transition. Peter Capaldi's leaving the role. You know, he did a good job with it, but he's ready to move on. And the showrunner, Stephen Moffat, is also moving on. So it's a good time for them to update the character. We've been talking about how this is the year of the woman. This is the ultimate recognition of that, a character with a 50-year history now finally being played by a woman.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, women are also big at Comic-Con this year, Wonder Woman among them. Comic-Con is where fans of science fiction, fantasy, comic books gather. It's in San Diego through Sunday. They're meeting the stars, checking out the buzz, and among them, NPR's Petra Mayer. Petra, what are you seeing?
I'm seeing lots of little girls, honestly. Everywhere I look, I'm also working on a story about children's comics, so I'm talking to a lot of kids. And everywhere I looked, there were little girls, and they were dressed up, and they were so excited to be here and to see all the celebrities and to talk about their favorite stuff. Also, I'm noticing a lot of the marketing has women in the foreground. That's new this year. I went to a press breakfast yesterday with DC Comics, not the first one I've been to, but definitely the first one where they've been careful to foreground their female artists and to talk about their popular line, DC Superhero Girls. And also just, you know, the marketing around the con. When you walk around and you look at the booths, a lot of them have their female characters foregrounded, or they have new lines that are aimed at young girls. It's really quite an interesting phenomenon.
Oh, that's so great. And when you talk about you see little girls dressed up, there's also cosplay going on here, which is people dressing up like their favorite characters. So are you seeing a lot of Wonder Woman? And is Wonder Woman's huge success pushing all this?
I think a lot of it is, and I am seeing a lot of Wonder Woman. You know, cosplay is a way that I tend to informally track what's really resonating with fans, and there are some evergreens. You're always going to see a lot of Star Wars, Star Trek, Game of Thrones. This year, there is a lot of Wonder Woman, and all different eras, not just Wonder Woman from the movie, but Wonder Woman from, you know, she's been around for 75 years, so lots of different Wonder Women. It's really cool to see.
Well, and just quickly, these costumes are so incredible. When you get in the middle of a cosplay crowd, it's just like being in a dream. And just what are you seeing? Is there one that jumps out at you?
There's always going to be one person who's just doing their passion project, something that, you know, wasn't ever popular to begin with, but they just love it. And this year, I think my favorite one of those that I've seen was a woman who had done herself like an almost picture-perfect version of the Johnny Depp Mad Hatter from the Tim Burton Alice in Wonderland. She looked amazing. I mean, it was gender-flipped. She had a big crinoline skirt, but like her makeup was on point. She had the wig, she had the hat, and I respected her dedication.
Comic-Con started as a comic book festival. Then they started promoting films there. This year, you say it's all about TV. What's going on?
Yeah, TV has had a pretty big presence for the past few years. This year, I do feel like it is the year of TV. When I talk to people about what they were excited about, you know, apart from Game of Thrones, the biggest thing people told me was Netflix. People are really into Netflix's programming, particularly Stranger Things 2. Netflix has a huge booth that was just packed every time I walked by. And you can also kind of tell what's up by looking at the immersive marketing installations, which are these sort of big themed things that fans can go into and have an experience related to their favorite show or movie. This year, so many TV ones. There's a Walking Dead one. There's Charlaine Harris, who created True Blood, has a new show called Midnight Texas that's being pushed really heavily. The Tick is being rebooted. Lots and lots and lots of TV marketing.
Okay. Well, you mentioned that DC Comics was pushing its superhero girls merchandise. Talk about merchandising and sales.
Man, people shop. The first few people that I talked to who were waiting in line and had been camped out since 1 in the morning on Wednesday to get into the convention that opened Thursday said they were here for collectibles, and they had already scored a little pile of Funko Pops, which are those big-headed collectible dolls. On Wednesday night for the preview night, the first thing I saw was people with giant piles of shopping bags. It's all about if you can even get in the line before it gets overfull and they close it. It's all about lining up at the booth for your favorite merchandise.
Well, Petra Mayer, the self-proclaimed nerd, you have joyously said that to us before. So, Petra, let your nerd freak flag fly.
I will. I don't have a costume this year, but next year I will.
Oh, one can hope. That's NPR's Petra Mayer at this year's Comic-Con International Convention in San Diego. Petra, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
This week, the combative president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, said he wants martial law to be extended for the rest of the year on the southern island of Mindanao. Mindanao has been immersed in conflict for decades. The government's fought Islamist separatists there and communist rebels. And in May, Duterte deployed his troops against a surge of militants reportedly funded by ISIS in Syria. The fighting on the island has forced hundreds of thousands to flee their homes. Carlos Conde is with Human Rights Watch. He's on Skype from Manila. Carlos, what is the current fighting all about?
Well, as far as the government is concerned, this is a conflict that's being waged against Islamic militants there who are supposedly linked with the Islamic State. But before all of this happened, there were already groups, Islamic groups in the southern Philippines who have been waging these insurgencies. And as with other problem areas in other parts of the world where the Islamic State would come in and try to basically hijack a local insurgency, that's what happened here. But to say that it's purely religious would probably be a simplistic thing to say at this point, because obviously the problems there are longstanding, and it hasn't been resolved for decades. And in fact, that is why there's an ongoing peace negotiations between the government and the Islamic separatist group, precisely to avert this kind of conflict.
So despite the peace negotiations going on, the fighting also goes on. You have been back and forth from Mindanao to Manila. What is it like for people who are living there amidst the government troops fighting and the jihadist forces fighting? What's it like?
Oh, it's terrible. I mean, nearly 500,000 people now have been displaced by this conflict, and they're dying of malnutrition. People are, the displaced are dying of diseases. There's a massive sanitation problem. And then, of course, the people, their way of life basically is upended. And because of the martial law, they're not able to pick up the pieces of their lives as easily as they hope to, because, for instance, they're required to produce identification that many of them don't, just to cite one case. So it is a huge problem.
So it's a huge problem for the displaced, and the declaration of martial law is expected to continue because the fighting is still going on. So the president has asked for an extension on the declaration. When you say that the people there are malnourished, some of them are starving, is no aid getting through?
There are aid getting through from various entities. The problem, however, is that unlike other conflicts in the past, majority of those who were displaced are not in evacuation camps. They are in they've been displaced in villages, living with relatives, and because of the security situation there, that makes it difficult for aid to reach them.
You're from Mindanao Island. I imagine you spent a lot of your life living with the conflict there. Do you see people you know there? What's it like when you go?
Every time I go there and talk to people, it's always a heartbreaker for me being from there. So Christians are not that affected. I'm a Christian, so they're not that affected by this conflict and many other conflicts before. But that only makes the situation even more depressing, because you see now a majority of the displaced Muslims and really, really poor citizens. And when I see them, when I go there, it just breaks my heart. You know, it's like the cycle of I would say destitution that you see when you go there.
You know, someone else who has very personal ties to the area is the president there, Duterte, who was a mayor of one of the cities on Mindanao Island. So this is kind of a personal issue for him as well.
I mean, people are responding to that fact with mixed feelings, because on the one hand, you have a president who is from there and who even claims to have some Muslim blood in him. But they see the devastation and they say, well, how could you do this? If you're from here, yeah, why is he waging a war against the Muslims in that area? I mean, if they're only targeting, for instance, Islamic militants, why do they have to destroy this whole city? You know, his response usually is that where he is dealing with an enemy that needs to be destroyed thoroughly.
And is there doubt about that?
I mean, in the way that he is waging this and is trying to destroy the militants, no, I don't think there's doubt, any doubt about that. He's shown that he's capable of doing that. The doubt would be, I think, whether those who have been targeted or killed, the nearly 500 of those alleged extremists who have been killed in this conflict, are actually extremists and not just some, you know, local citizens, local residents who got killed in the process. So, you know, they don't know. But again, the bottom line is that a lot of the Muslims in Mindanao have turned against him in terms of the public opinion.
Well, we appreciate your speaking with us. Carlos Conde is a researcher at Human Rights Watch. He's in Manila and covering the Philippines. Thank you very much, Carlos.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins. Jeremy Hobson will be back on Monday.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.